Hey Lily, product people come from lots of different backgrounds. Do you know anyone who did something unusual before getting their start in the field?
I think the most unusual was probably someone who was the lead singer of a heavy metal band before she got into product.
That's a good one. I had a couple of musicians in mind. We've had Jeff Gotthelf and Matt LeMay on the podcast, who were both musicians. I know someone who's an Olympic speed skater, and we definitely have to book them sometime. And I did work with someone who was a Polish Navy helicopter pilot. But I think lead singer of a heavy metal band, actually, that takes the cake.
And we do have someone on today who got his start as a 911 operator. And for bonus points, he's here to tell us some of the stories about how that work directly impacted the way that he works today.
His name is Nathan Henry. He's the Associate Director of Product Management at New York agency Postlight. And, you know, I'm just not going to waste any more time on this intro. Let's get straight to it.
The product experience is brought to you by Mind the Product.
Every week, we talk to the best product people from around the globe about how we can improve our practice and build products that people love.
Visit mindtheproduct.com to catch up on past episodes and to discover an extensive library of great content and videos.
Browse for free or become a Mind the Product member to unlock premium articles, unseen videos, AMAs, roundtables, discounts to our conferences around the world, training opportunities, and more.
Mind the Product also offers free Product Tank meetups in more than 200 cities, and there's probably one near you. Hi, Nathan. Thank you so much for joining us on the Product Experience. It's really lovely to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited.
So before we get stuck into our topic this evening, it would be great if you could give us and the listeners a quick intro into your life in product and kind of how you got started. And we're going to cover some of your early history. So just give us an intro into what you're doing now.
Sure. I'll bury the lead. I won't go there. So currently, I am Associate Director of Product Management at Postlight, which is a strategy firm in Manhattan. So I'm in New York. And as you alluded to, my background is very non-traditional. But I think that's common with product managers. I don't know of anyone that's ever growing up as a five-year-old saying, oh, I want to be a product manager when I grow up. And so for me, I know this isn't probably part of your question, but for me, that's still the most fascinating part of our profession, is that there's just not one way into it. Everybody comes with like different experiences and they bring that with them, and then they share that. I think we have a very sharing community where everyone can sort of learn from that. I find that that experience is so unique to our profession and something that I learn every day from other product managers. And I think that has a lot to do with sort of the backgrounds that we bring as our collective selves to our craft.
Yeah, absolutely. There's not yet a product manager Barbie or anything like that to
maybe
come, I'm sure. Yeah. So going back to your very early career then, you started as a 911 operator. Is that the right terminology for the role? Yeah.
Yep, that's true. So sometimes called dispatcher, but yes, when you were in crisis and called 911, I was on the other end of that line. So yeah, that's how I started. I was a poor college student in the 90s and needed a job that hopefully was a little bit more than minimum wage. And my local sheriff's department was hiring part-time help. So it was, you know, nights and weekends, which is great. I could take classes. I had time to study, potentially, you know, when nights were smaller or slower. I think back in the day, it might have been like $8 an hour, which in the 90s was a lot of money for a 19-year-old kid. I mean, I remember being able to buy books and an occasional drink or Taco Bell. So like, I think that was probably a good thing. So yeah, that was my very non-traditional start. And I believe for me, that laid the best groundwork for how I think about product and users.
So before we get into the kind of the synergies between being a 911 operator and working as a product manager, which I'm dying to get stuck into, how did you actually make that transition from that role into product?
Sure. So the career timeline here, so I was a 911 operator, then eventually 911 supervisor, which is a whole other can of worms that we'll just leave on the table. At some point, I finally realized I should finish that degree. Going through college and as a part-time job, like, it became a full-time job and college stopped. So after about 11 years, I decided to go back and pick up my degree in information technology, which wasn't a thing when I started at 911. So that's how quickly the world evolved. And got my first job out of college as a early 30-something in web design and web programming. I had a hobby and a passion. I had fan sites for tennis players. Finally got my degree and got a job in Chicago. And boy, that was just the best. And eventually moved from front end to back end. And at one particular point, I had to explain how a database worked to a customer. We were normalizing really boring sort of spreadsheets, but no one understood it. And I was able to speak the technical programming in a way that made sense to the customer. And the company that I was working with, they're like, oh, you're good at that. Like, you should just tell all the clients like what we're going to do from like a technical standpoint, because they can understand you. And I thought that's my path to product. Like, I could speak to clients about technical things, and they just kept doing that more and more. And then eventually I learned that was called product management. And that's kind of where I went and how I got here. So few jumps in between there from companies and different roles, but that was kind of the synergy here, was always speaking to users about technical needs and how we could do something or how something could work based on changes that we could make to a system.
So when you talk to clients or customers or stakeholders, there's one thing that they always want to know. They want to know, when can I have it? How much is it going to cost? Why don't I have it yet? But when you work in emergency services, you know that there's no such thing as a stable plan. So how do you deal with people that are asking for certainty when the entire point of product management is that we're not certain?
For sure. I think for me, the first thing is just setting like expectations. What is real? What do we know? What are unknowns? And just being very clear around what the ask is, how you get there, and just being very clear on it takes these three steps and it takes this long. You know, here's trade-offs that you can make. I'm really good around proposing trade-offs or optionality, and just making sure that we agree into those decisions collectively and that everyone has the information that they need to make those decisions. I think sometimes a mistake that could be made is proposing like an option A or an option B just on its surface as a bullet point, whereas I think you need a little bit more than pros and cons even. I think you need to go another stretch deeper and like, how will this decision impact your users? How will this impact your business? And so keeping those two things layering into like any sort of optionality helps you go into a joint plan. And then when that plan is sort of agreed upon or you know, discussed and solidified, that becomes the plan. And then any changes have to kind of go back through that exercise. So it's kind of a rinse, wash, and repeat that gets, you know, possibly frustrating depending on decisions that are being made and unmade. But you know what you know today, and tomorrow there'll be new challenges to iterate for.
Sometimes when things change, though, people get stressed. And I'm guessing your background might have give you some techniques of how to talk people down from, I was going to say from the ledge, but that feels way too on point for this.
That's definitely on the nose.
Yeah. But you're just de-escalating a situation. How do you deal with that? Is that something you recognize in people sometimes?
It is. So I guess maybe I can talk about sort of my world lens here and how I approach the world. I feel is a little bit different than other folks. Like, I'll approach those situations that could be contentious of, no one's dying today. Like, I think it's a very small number of product decisions that would yield into someone dying. They probably exist, but probably not what I'm working on a day-to-day. So I take that as sort of a centering of, you know, whatever decision you're making, no one's going to die. So you don't have to be right. You have to know what's best and provide that best counsel. And so for me, when someone is stressed, de-escalating the situation is the first thing that you need to do there. And that can just be by earning their trust, telling the person or the client, the stakeholder, that they've been heard and that you do have, you know, plans to fix this. You're going to find the best path forward for them. You're going to give them the best option that's possible, and really just working to gain their trust, gain, you know, clear communications, using transparency to show them, here's the options, here's the plan, here's the best way forward, and really being that strategic counsel for them in this decision, whatever that decision needs to be made. Focusing it on the problem, removing the stress, and providing clarity would be the three things that I would suggest are the easiest way to help sort of de-escalate a stressful situation.
And was that kind of very much your training as an operator to follow those principles?
Definitely. I think for me, you have to take, well, for 911, you have to take emotion out. When things are happening quick and life and death is quite literally in the balance, you don't have time for emotion. You don't have time to react with words that don't mean something. I think I've learned to try to ask targeted, direct questions that can be answered succinctly. In 911, you don't have time to answer grandiose, you know, dream state questions or open-ended questions. You need a very specific answer, so you have to ask a targeted question. The second part of that is, depending on the answer to that question, you need to be thinking already of what your next question is. You know, depending on the answer, if it's A or B, what is the next thing that I need to know? So you have to be trying to stay one step ahead, and you need to be doing this very quickly too. So there's always a time element here. So there's a very fast paced nature of, you know, taking information, but you're thinking of the next thing, and you're probably having, you know, different conversation in one ear, you know, your right ear from your left ear. You might be having, you know, a caller in one ear and police dispatch or ambulance in the other ear. So you have this sort of dual brain flow and you're hearing two things at one time. That is a skill that I don't own anymore. And I am okay with that, because that caused a lot of, you hear everything and then sometimes you don't want to hear everything. So I've kind of learned to let that part go just a bit.
It sounds like that could be really useful when you do user research, but it also sounds like it's when you're taking those calls, you're trying to direct them. You know what kind of information you want. You're trying to concentrate them. Is that something you ever use when doing research, or is it exactly the opposite, that you want to be more open-ended and see where they go?
I think there's a couple, it shows up in a different ways. I think when situations are very ambiguous, I think you need to strive for clarity. And asking targeted questions when you have a very ambiguous problem or a problem space helps. Now, some of those questions aren't relevant, but you wouldn't know that unless you asked. Now, I think as it relates to like users, and you know, I kind of zoom into like feature planning or feedback on a feature, that should be a little bit less targeted, because you really want to get a little bit more around the interaction or the thought process. That's maybe where some emotion could come in, or letting the time element sort of de-escalate in priority to sort of actually get observations, to really hear how something's being used. So I think it's a muscle that I can flex depending on when I need to flex it. But again, when things are ambiguous, if I asked grandiose questions, I feel like I'm just furthering the ambiguity. I feel like I need to strive for clarity. And if I ask a question that isn't relevant and I get an answer of that's not on point here or that's not the right answer, I think that even helps me. Even though it might seem misdirected, it actually tells me to go, you know, to not go down that pursuit of questioning anymore, change to a different topic and sort of pursue that and see where that goes.
There's that kind of old adage of, I think it was Einstein that said, you know, if I had an hour to solve a problem, I'd spend the first 55 minutes on the question. And it sounds like you've spent a lot of time practicing asking questions and asking the right questions. So with the targeted questions that you're talking about, like what makes a targeted question? Is it, you know, what are the characteristics of a very targeted question? Because to me, it almost sounds like a sort of yes, no type answer, but then that often shuts down the conversation.
Sure. I think it depends on what you're trying to get out of the conversation. I think sometimes you approach, you know, a product question, you're needing clarity. You need to understand how a feature will work or how an assumption has been made. So for me, in asking a targeted question, it's not about limiting the answer. It's about allowing the question to be so clearly understood that the answer itself is obvious. And so it's phrasing, it's using words that are clearly understood. I'll do this activity where I will think of the questions that I want to ask. I'll just brainstorm a list of, you know, 5 or 6 questions that I want to ask an interview subject. And what I'll do is I'll ask it to myself. Is this the right phrasing? Are these words clear? Are there anything colloquial here or anything that assumes that there's a background or has an assumption based on knowledge that the person may or may not have? So it's really the targeting is the words and how the question is formulated, but hopefully the answer isn't certainly a yes or a no. Hopefully it is, here's my answer. And then because of the question, I can back it up with some rationale, or there's an anecdote, or, you know, some other thread that can then be pulled from for a follow-up question.
The other place where this sounds incredibly useful to me is when you're trying to get enough information to prioritize things. You know, in back when I was in university, I spent just a couple of months working on an ambulance, and the concept of triage was something I had to learn. And it sounds like there's a huge overlap between triage and prioritization, but you're trying to take imperfect information and make a decision at pace. Is that something that is an overlap for you as well?
100%. I think, as we talked about earlier in the interview here, that there's no path, there's no sort of college degree in product management. If there were, I think one of the lab classes would be that everyone should have to audit a 911 call center for a couple of weeks, because that's where you learn prioritization. So I'm kind of on the same wavelength as you, that triaging and prioritization are very critically intertwined. I think for me, the volume of information and the ability to process split-second decisions, you have to sort of understand like how to vet the information, validate it in real time, and make a decision. And it might not be the right decision overall, but it's the right decision in that moment. I think it's important to understand you can only solve the problem that's in front of you with the information that you have. I think, you know, also recognizing like volume. You may have a feature request that has 1,000 people that are asking for that, but it doesn't really move the needle. And maybe there's something that one person has asked, but it's the most important thing that actually moves the needle a little bit further for your product. I think of that same thing, kind of at 911. When there's loud fireworks on 4th of July, you would get thousands of calls. Yes, it's a problem. It's loud, it's fireworks, it's 4th of July. But there's not, at the end of the day, not a bunch that you can do about it. But when there's someone in their critical moment of need having a medical emergency, it's one voice. So like obviously in a prioritization exercise, the volume of 911 fireworks, sure, there's a lot of those, but the ambulance for the person having possibly a heart attack is clearly the pattern here. Not all options are that easy and that clear to delineate. But yeah, I think understanding that information with what you have and being able to make the best decision with the information that you have, and then evolving when you learn more or hear different pieces of information and you're able to validate it, make a lot of sense.
So when it isn't as straightforward, when you're triaging 911, what are the techniques that you use in order to make that decision, you know, under that pressure and having to kind of move quickly? Because maybe there's something there that's helpful for us product folk as well.
So I think with that, I think it's being confident in your decision. Also knowing that the decision that you've made might not be right, but it's the best that you have. I think also factoring some level of confidence. Maybe that's because you've solved that problem before, or you have experience of someone that solved it before. So there's some muscle memory or some shared experiences that you could at least seek as sort of a way to pattern your decisioning. I think it's important to know also that, yes, you're ultimately responsible for decisions in the product, but you have a team. You have some pieces of a team together. You could have engineers, you could have designers. You also just have colleagues that you could ask questions to. Yes, you know, there's a time element. Everything has to be fast. But the problems that we solve likely have been solved before, probably in a different flavor, probably in a different manner for a different vertical. So again, it kind of goes that targeted question, like what do you really need to know that probably could fit some other vertical or some problem that's been solved if you're able to find the right way to ask the question. And if it's a truly unique problem, I want to work on that product with you because I think you're onto something that could be revolutionary.
UserLeap makes it easy to build and embed micro surveys into your product to learn about your customers in real time. Product teams at companies such as Square, Adobe, and Dropbox use UserLeap to gather qualitative insights as easily as they get quantitative ones and automatically analyze the results so teams can take quick action.
If you're part of an agile product team that believes in building better products, and I sure hope you are, by obtaining insights from users, then give UserLeap a try for free by visiting userleap.com. That is userleap.com.
So you're used to dealing with people, or you have experience dealing with people anyway, at potentially the most stressful moment of their life. And one of our former guests, Janet Bastow, has a great line about, you know, what's really hard about managing product, about product management is managing people and relationships more than the actual triage and technical decisions and things like that. And, you know, we give nicknames to different kinds of hard stakeholders. We call them hippos and seagulls and zebras and things like that. When you're dealing with people who are challenging personalities and trying to change the dynamic, is there anything from your background that gives you an edge on how to handle them?
Yeah, I don't know if it's an edge, but I do categorize people. I don't know that I categorize them in the exact same terminology that you have. I have an interrupter. And so drawing back to my 911 days, inevitably at the busiest storm when possibly, you know, maybe there's a tornado warning or something busy, a snowstorm, something bad is happening. You're very busy. There's a lot of activity happening throughout the municipality. And there's always the interrupter that's going to call because there's a raccoon on her porch, or there is a loud siren outside for a fire emergency. And that person is an interrupter. You have to still treat that user. I'm going to use the word user here as a 911 system. You still have to treat that user with respect. You still have to address their concerns. You still have to, you know, file a ticket, whether it be in the backlog or an actual ticket. Like, that's still an input that you have to decide. So having empathy for users is extremely important, even when you don't want to hear what they have to say. Like, if you're very busy on something else, that interrupter is the last thing you have time for. But you also have to understand that that user still matters. They may not be your primary user. They may not be the user that you even want to use your product. But at the same time, they're a user. Anyone has access. So you have to treat them as such. Now, what share of voice you give them and how, you know, how you prioritize their needs, that's a different activity. But again, I think having that empathy, I'm able to scale that across the board and understand people's motivations, really bringing it back to the product, making sure that, you know, decisions are being made for the, you know, the whole of the product. We're trying to move things forward, leading with that lens. And then my last trick, if all of that fails, I've always found donuts are a good solution. I will always reference a donut, talk about donuts, ask about donuts. I currently have one of my clients every Friday in our presentation, we do a status. I put a different donut photo in every client status just to kind of keep it. It's a highlight. It's a hallmark. I feel like I'm serving value, but I digress.
I feel like there's a euphemism there that people will hold on to of like, oh, there's a raccoon on the porch whenever a requirement comes in that's really just like not necessary right now.
Yeah, the interrupter, the raccoon on the porch, or I would have this lovely woman. I don't want to give her actual name. I pray that she's still fine. She would call every single night at 8 o'clock on 911, and she would just cry. And I clearly there was some mental fragility there. She would tell you stories from the 40s and 50s and her life and things. And she would just be sobbing, I think missing family or what have you. And all she wanted you to do was tell her that you loved her. And she would say thank you and good night. And then she would go to bed and you wouldn't hear from her until 8 o'clock the next afternoon. So that user also exists. So your regular user that just has a very self-service, you know, very easy to solve problem, even though it's on a repeat. So that's also a different type of user.
So what are some of the other ways in which you've noticed similarities or synergies between products and 911?
I think where they're different, I have to answer this in a couple of different ways here. I think where they're different is what I really liked about 911 was the unplanned chaos. There would be some nights where you would work for 12 hours, you would take one breath, it was sheer panic, sheer terror, and like just the worst of the worst things could happen, but you couldn't wait to go do it again tomorrow. And so that's where that's the same for me. Like, I can't wait to make product decisions tomorrow. I'm excited to know, what are we solving? How can we fix this problem? So it's a different level of anxiety, admittedly. It's a different level of temperature. Like I said, no one's dying, but you know, making decisions and actually, you know, collaborating on something and solving a user's needs through some action that you're taking, you know, it doesn't have to be a critical episode. It could be a very small user feature, but really working through with your teammates and your client team to really understand the best way making a good decision that maybe someone else couldn't see, or a pattern that doesn't exist that you're working to strive for clarity on. Like, for me, that's the same thing. You're at the end of the day, you're helping your users by providing some clarity or some service that they can then be enabled to get help, find clarity, whatever it might be for them.
So something else I've noticed that's a bit of an overlap is back when I did my very brief stint, people had to find coping mechanisms of how to deal with the stress of doing their job. And I meet a lot of product managers who feel the same way, you know, that all the responsibility, known as the power problem of representing things, but not necessarily being able to drive everything. Is there anything you've learned about how to de-stress, or just, you know, how to turn off at the end of the day and leave the job at the job?
Yeah, I think that was the most important thing. You know, again, as a 19-year-old working at 911, I heard the literal worst of humanity, and I heard people in their most darkest time of need. And I took that home a lot. I took those voices home. I took those actions home. I took that home with me. And at some point, you have to stop. You have to realize that you've done your best, you made your decisions, you provided the help, you've answered that. So for me, in product decisions, you know, again, I still lead with no one's dying today. Like, that is a thing that I get to say, because with my product decisions, no one is going to die. Whereas before, that wasn't always a certainty. Like, there was a very, you know, real chance that someone was going to die when I was doing my job. Not for lack of anything untoward, just that's the nature of that type of work. So for me, really understanding at the end of the day, the worst thing that could happen is your feature doesn't work. Your website doesn't launch. It's okay. It isn't ideal. Your clients might be mad. Your team might be disappointed. There might be some financial issues that your company has to deal with, but it's at the end of the day, it's a website. It's a feature. It's, you know, you can log a bug in Jira and fix it tomorrow. So I think just keeping it, you know, really honest to yourself with how relevant that needs to feel. Yeah, you can beat yourself up for making a bad mistake. I think you should learn from mistakes, but I don't think you should take it home with you. I don't think you should be thinking about it tomorrow. I think instead of dwelling on it, how do you fix it the next time? How do you fix it right now? How do you learn from this? And I think actually sitting with that and understanding, like, how would I handle the situation differently is what I try to do. Sometimes it takes a minute. I fall into old habits. We're human. We all have that. But I think really focusing on the positive and what you can learn and how you can be better prepared to handle that next time. Because again, no one's dying.
Is it as simple as that? I mean, in terms of you put it in context, you make a decision, and you give yourself permission to relapse once in a while, but try and get better? Or is there other things like doing meditation, doing other things that really make a difference as well?
Sure. Well, my first coping strategy is definitely donuts. I think I've mentioned that earlier, but donuts always help. I think it's fair. I think for me, acknowledging this, there's something sitting with me, it's bothering me. My number one tip is acknowledge it. Say it out loud. Write it down. I think the worst thing someone could see of my work history would be my Slack DMs to myself, because that's where I have like my failed product ideas, or where I sort of chastise myself for maybe not making the right decision or doing something wrong. So, but I also use that as my outlet. I will say that thing to myself in Slack because I don't want to say it out loud because I'm in an office and that would be weird. But I want to tell myself that because I feel like I need to acknowledge that. I need to give that power, because once I let it out into the world, I don't own it anymore. I don't have to think on that. I have to dwell on that. And I can choose to then do something about that. I can say, you know what? That decision wasn't great, but here's what I would do next time. Here's how we would handle that. Or maybe it was just the decision that was I made because it's the information that I had, and I can give myself permission to move on from it. But I think acknowledging is something that I find people don't do. They'll hang on to things a little bit too long. Get it out there, let it go, move on, and just do better the next time. Easier said than done, but that would be my tip.
I think that's a really great tip, actually. And it reminds me of, do you know Brené Brown, the author? Yeah. She wrote in one of her books, I think it was Rising Strong. So she writes about shame and kind of recovering from shame, basically, and trying to be braver. And she gives very similar advice around, you know, if something happens to you, like get it out, write it down. And she calls it like the shitty first draft of, you know, you can behave like a child because no one's ever going to read it. And you can say exactly what you think. You don't have to be professional or grown up. You can just get it all out of your system. And it's very therapeutic. So, yeah, I think that's excellent advice.
Yeah, once you get it out of your brain, it doesn't have power over you anymore. You can choose to have power over that thought, that sentiment, whatever it might be. So yeah, I'm a big fan of, if it takes up space in my head, it's bothering me. So let me get it out in some fashion.
Yeah, I think that's great advice.
So you talked about letting go of stress and things. Another way that I find to be useful in, and something we've talked about in the past, is doing some scenario planning and preparedness planning, getting ready for things. And I know when you work in emergency services, you have disaster plans and you have things to for worst case. How does that work? How did you carry over? I know you said earlier to us that you carried over something from that into your approach. How does that cross over?
Sure. So one of the things I most quickly learned was that you should plan. You should have some level of planning. I can give you a quick anecdote. This is a true story. My literal first call that I ever took as a 911 operator, I started the 3 to 11 shift, and it was 3 o'clock exactly. And the call was a hostage situation, a man with a gun holding his family with hostage situation. And there were shots fired at the time. And so I had no plan. I have no idea what I'm doing. This is day one for me, learning and trying to do this new job as a 19-year-old kid with no experience in this world. And so for me, I will always remember, I didn't have a plan to get out of that situation, but I made one really quickly, let me tell you that. And so my planning was, I have to get help. How do I get help? And what's the first step I take? What's the second step I take? And make quick, fast decisions. I could go on to that story more and more, but for me, that told me I cannot approach situations without any sort of thought or planning anymore. So that was my learning tool. So what I do is I also tend to have a doomsday perspective because of that job and working in there for 13 years. Like, not much good happened. There was good, but not all good. So for me, when I go into an unknown situation, I actually ask myself, what's the worst thing that can happen? What is the failure here? What's the worst thing that can happen? And if I acknowledge that's the worst thing that can happen, chances are it's probably not that bad anyway, but it gives me a place to sort of give that space to talk about it, put it out into the ecosystem, and then actually begin to, like, it dials down my tension, my anxiety, to start focusing on, okay, well, what do I need to get out of this meeting? Like, what do I need to get out of this decision? I don't start from, oh my gosh, I can't handle it. I start from, like, well, that's not going to happen. So what is going to happen? It's almost like a funneling activity, I suppose. But I would think, maybe I'm an over planner, but I plan for every scenario as much as you can. Life throws curveballs all the time. Of course, you can't over plan. But I think specifically around product decisions or client meetings, you know, new engagements for clients, those types of things, really understanding, what do you need to get out of this? What value are you bringing? And what's the worst thing that can happen? Those are three questions I'm going to ask myself every time I go into a situation, because then I know what I'm striving for. I also know what's not going to happen. The worst thing is likely ever the thing that's going to happen, but at least I've announced it. I've made peace with it in case it does happen. It doesn't. And then I can have a productive meeting from there. I'd rather start my lens of possibilities from what's not possible than try to find myself being clarity and having lack of context, or just even creating anxiety that I don't need. I want to focus on, like, moving forward in positivity and not sort of spiraling into, like, the abyss of unknowns and question marks.
So when you're thinking about planning for the worst, you kind of mentioned that you think about it in terms of, like, you know, meetings that you're attending and things like that. But are there other sort of work scenarios where you're thinking about planning for the worst? I'm just thinking about, you know, you could take that to the extreme. So how often, you know, are you doing that scenario planning?
That's true. I don't do scenario planning on every decision that I make, but sometimes for product decisions, specifically maybe when I'm, you know, just divining, like, an MVP or a release candidate, you know, decisioning, if this feature doesn't go in, what's the worst that could happen? Like, what is the worst impact to that user? So it's a little bit smaller of a lens of worst, but worst still being sort of the thing that you're trying to solve for. Like, I want to quantify how bad could it be? I'm looking for that input to help me sort of guide what is the best way forward here. A lot of times it surfaces in a way where I don't have all the information that I need. So I find sometimes in agency work, you work quicker with less enriched data. Sometimes you just don't have access to all of the users or all the stakeholders. And so if I don't have confidence to the level that I feel good about with a decision, that's kind of where I bring in that, well, what's the worst that could happen mentality. Sometimes the answers are clear. Sometimes the situation is familiar. I'm not going to, you know, sort of over plan in those engagements, but there are times when I find that activity to be really helpful to understand the risks and making sure that I'm at least acknowledging the risk. And then if I choose to take that risk, I at least have a baseline to understand what could be the worst thing that could happen, right? I don't think it's ever going to get to that point, but at least I've understood the consequence of that risk.
Nathan, I'm sure we could ask you a lot more questions about this, but unfortunately we're running out of time. But we would be completely remiss if we didn't ask you one really critical question. You've alluded to it a number of times, but you've never told us, what is your favorite donut?
Oh, my favorite donut. And I'm going to give them the plug for this. I don't own this company. There's a couple locations in New York City, in Manhattan. It's called Daily Provisions. And they have crullers. They have different flavors of crullers, and they're all wonderful. But the maple cruller from Daily Provisions is by far, in a way, the best single-handed donut I've ever had in Earth. And I have traveled and eaten a lot of donuts in a lot of places, and they are number one by far. I actually use that as a litmus test to determine if we're friends or not. I brought a box into the office, and I saw who took and who didn't, and I kept a list. I'm not gonna kid. I was aware of that.
Do you have your own personal discount code that you want to like give out to anyone? Or
I don't, but I really feel like I should at least get like, you know, half off or something of my next one.
It's going to be a couple weeks between the time we record this and the time it goes out. So if you get a chance and you send it in to us, we'll put it in the show notes.
There you go.
Nathan, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really fascinating hearing about your time in the emergency services and also your time in product.
Thank you so much. It was so great to be here. Longtime listener, first time guest. So maybe I'll be back if people found my stories fun. I'd be happy to have a part two and I'll bring donuts.
And for anyone listening, Nathan is threatening to write a book about this. So do let him know if you want to hear more.
I have a lot of, I have 13 years worth of stories. I didn't give you the roadkill story. We'll save that for a part two.
Fantastic. Thank you, Nathan.
Thank you so much.
Please do give Nathan a shout if you're interested to learn more about how his role at 911 is similar to product and you want him to write the book. Or maybe you share the same career history and can also share how emergency services shaped you as a product person.
It would make a lot of sense if the product world was full of X91 operators. I mean, from that conversation, there's a ton of transferable skills. Speaking of which, do you fancy joining us on the podcast to tell your own story?
If you do, then give us a shout on Twitter at MTPpod. The guest form is linked to in our bio.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Our hosts are me, Lily Smith, and
me, Randy Silver.
Emily Tate is our producer, and Luke Smith is our editor.
Our theme music is from Hamburg-based band POW, that's PAU. Thanks to Arne Kittler, who runs Product Tank and MTP Engage in Hamburg, and plays bass in the band, for letting us use their music. Connect with your local product community via Product Tank, our regular free meetups in over 200 cities worldwide.
If there's not one near you, you can consider starting one yourself. To find out more, go to mindtheproduct.com/Product Tank.
Product Tank is a global community of meetups driven by and for product people. We offer expert talks, group discussion, and a safe environment for product people to come together and share learnings and tips.